Supreme Court of Ohio, now in open session, pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, please be seated. First case on our calendar is 99-14-44, Rena Lee Gleiner versus St. Gobain Norton Industrial Ceramics Corporation. Mr. Sindel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope to reserve 5 minutes for...
Watch your time. Clock is screwed.
Okay.
The basic issue in this case is the right to trial by jury. Unbelievable.
Discrimination cases. The evidence in this case on behalf of the four women I represented at trial was substantial. There was statistical information. There was evidence, I should say. There was evidence of a decision-making process that was infected with gender discriminatory animus. There was evidence of notice by the Human Resources Director to the decision-makers that there may be gender discrimination in terms of the decision to terminate in the reorganization. There was evidence that this company did not truthfully have an economic crisis in order to justify the reduction in force that was otherwise motivated and they were impeached in that regard. There was evidence that there was pay discrimination generally across the board in this company as between females and males. There was evidence in each individual case with comparators of lower discriminatory pay and testimony by several witnesses in those cases individually as they were tried together, that the women were being paid in violation of the company policy. There was pretextual evidence which the jury chose not to believe, articulated reasons for terminating or for pay, which the jury had a right to disbelieve because they were contested. There was evidence in this case to justify punitive damages as well, because all of these actions were taken, certainly in conscious disregard. To review some of that, of the rights of the plaintiff, to review some of that evidence, statistically, in a general way, in the hate point categories, in every 100 hate point category that you get right across the board, throughout the entire company, women were paid less than men in the same category. The management incentive program, which was the upper echelon, naturally higher paid group, had never had any female member at all. And as a matter of fact, while ineligible males were made into management incentive program, MIP members, eligible females, one in particular, Christine Keller, was kept out, notwithstanding her clear eligibility as the high, and she was the highest paid female in the company.
Counsel?
Yes, Judge Stratton.
Your arguments basically go to a weighing of the facts. You weigh them one way, the jury weighs them one way, the court feels it weighs them another way. We're not an error correction court. We look at principles of law. What principle of law what principle of law are you trying to establish here other than profit jury, which is certainly not a principle of law as well established?
Well, the principle of law is that in reviewing the legal sufficiency of the evidence to support a verdict, an appellate court must be proved to the evidentiary weight and credibility of the determinations of the jury.
That's already a principle of law.
That's a simple
law. Well, if we reverse court rules, we're simply error correcting, are we not?
Well,
but that's not a good principle, is it?
Well, I think the principle includes something else. I think this Supreme Court has a supervisory responsibility with respect to appellate courts in the state and trial judges. And that is a very serious responsibility. If one looks, Your Honor, at the employment cases throughout the state, particularly the next year or two,
there, responsibility requires corruption in?
I don't know about all the corruption.
We have a lot of courts of appeals that we reassume they have, I don't think they were right, because no principle of law, we don't take it in.
Well, the principle of law is obvious, it's the application of the principle that this court should address, because it is a widespread problem. Case after case after case is being, plaintiffs' verdicts are being thrown out, because for some reason courts are not treating employment cases like other cases. And that is something that needs to be addressed, or it's probably going to continue. And just because it's the application of well-worn principle of law doesn't mean it's something this court should simply ignore.
So, if I'm correct in understanding, it is error correction, but you think we need to do it because too many courts are erring in this area?
I have a list. Campbell versus Food Specialties, $368,000 verdict, $1.2 million.
We took that case in, did we not?
What's that?
We took that case in, did we not?
Yes, yes.
And we ruled on it, did we not?
Well, the same principle would apply.
But we obviously didn't agree that there was error correction.
Well, I don't know what reason you took this case, but error correction is not something that has anything
to do with it. Aren't there some issues that need to be developed in this area of discrimination? This is not just, and we did not take this case in because it's error correction. There are gender discrimination issues here that need to be focused upon.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, one of the big problems in this area right now is the evidentiary problem. How do you weigh and evaluate the evidence, both on summary judgment and from the standpoint of jury instruction, and sufficiency of the evidence? I think the Burns case is, frankly, a very questionable, which I believe should be disproved.
This court has the Mousy case and the Burns case, and they're conflicting one with the other. This is certainly an opportunity to clarify those two rulings.
And I think that the lack of clarification that exists, as you pointed out, Your Honor, is what is causing the problem. Look.
Exactly, because the courts of appeals do not know which case to follow, whether they should follow Mousy or should they follow Burns.
Precisely, and that is the source of the injustice, and this case is just one example of it. There is an abundance of evidence in this case, and the correction of error should not be so easily slighted because it's the correction of injustice.
On that point, Mr. Sindel, you ask us to reverse and reinstate the judgment of the trial court. Is that correct? That means then that you would agree that in the Joyner and the DeLuga claims, the jury found for the employer on the termination claims.
That's correct.
So therefore, you're not appealing that.
Absolutely correct.
What makes termination in their two cases different than the other two cases?
Well, because in each set of termination cases, Your Honor, there were different evidence, different sets of facts.
Yeah, and you've laid it all out.
I tried very hard to do that. It was a very long...
But the bottom line in each of them is that you say they were all improperly terminated as well as discriminated against with regard to pay classification.
That's correct. I believe what it shows is the care which the jury took. In the Joyner case and in the DeLuga case, as distinguished from the Noack case, the Joyner case, Your Honor, I think the evidence may have been less compelling because there was no direct comparator in those latter two cases. There was nobody exactly alike with the same exact position, the same exact endpoint, that would be a direct comparator. And so I think that the jury was very careful in examining the different cases and concluding that there simply wasn't enough evidence. In case of Linda Joyner, she was terminated and apparently not replaced. So it was different evidence.
The jury gave specific verdicts in the other two cases, Noack and Gleiner. Is that right, Gleiner?
Yes.
Gleiner?
Yes.
In those two cases, for discriminatory termination, is part of that reinstatement?
No.
Just the compensatory and punitive damages?
That's correct.
So therefore, the only difference that we would find in
if you went through this record meticulously, as I've tried to do, because the facts are different with each of them, but you're willing to accept that the first two were not, in fact, improperly terminated.
Well, I'm willing to accept that the verdict of the jury was one which, given the evidence, they could have reached. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I don't think the defense verdicts are were unreasonable in this case. I don't think the plaintiff's verdicts were unreasonable in this case. I think they all should be sustained, and I didn't appeal.
I just had one more question, because I was interested in the fact that there seemed to be a stipulation of the parties with regard to prejudgment interest.
Yes, there was.
Isn't that unusual, to say the least?
I can't say that I was upset with it.
No, but I'm wondering why respondent, or why the defendants in this case, the corporation, would agree to prejudgment interest before there was even a verdict.
Well, I suppose you should direct that to my opponent as to why she...
Well, but you were there. You know what the negotiations were. Why would...
Well, that's true. The offers were very, very minimal, certainly, compared to the verdict. And I'm not misquoting my opponent, but I think Ms. Heary told me that she didn't feel she had a good faith argument to oppose prejudgment interest.
Okay, thank you.
I certainly didn't want to argue with that. I don't know exactly how much time I have.
We have more than 2 minutes. A white light means you have 2 minutes and it's not on yet.
Okay.
So,
I'd like to take my 5 minutes. Unless there's any other questions, I'd like to reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal so I get the full time.
Thank you, Mr. Dell. Ms. Heary.
Have you ever heard of that? Have you ever seen that?
No.
That just tells me what they need.
They fight the hell out of each other.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here today for the Cordelia Theory on behalf of the Bank of West. This case never should have gone to trial. And once the plaintiff has concluded his evidence, the case should never have gone to the jury. There was no evidence of gender discrimination. There was no evidence of pretext. There was an insufficient amount of evidence to send any of the material issues to the jury. This appeal does not raise any constitutional issues. This appeal does not raise any issues relating to greater general public interest. This is entirely fact sensitive. It's a review of the sufficiency of the evidence, no more, no less. If one looks at the briefs filed on the FCPL, and in particular the reply brief, we have 18 pages of argument of facts. We have not one reference to a proposition of law. Indeed, there's not one case cited in the reply brief.
So let's concede that it's a fact-sensitive case. Aren't those facts, you say that should never have gone to the jury, aren't those facts, some of them pretty devastating? For instance, these women were all in equal positions and being paid less. The engineer particularly bothers me, I'll tell you right up front.
Ms. Leiner?
Mm-hmm. She'd been there for 7 more years or something than her counterpart, a male, who was paid substantially more.
Your Honor, I'm happy to address that. Ms. Leiner was employed for about 7 years as a product engineer. She chose to compare herself with Daniel Herr, who was a recent hire. Mr. Herr was paid roughly $4,000 or $5,000 more than Ms. Leiner for the following reasons. He was recruited from Lockheed in April of 1995. He had substantially different skills. He had documentation and methodology skills, which were sorely lacking in the engineering department. At the time that he was hired, he was making $3,000 or $4,000 more than Ms. Leiner was making at Micron. In order to get him to come to Micron, they had to match his salary. Salary matching is a legitimate criterion for differential, for disparate pay treatment. And in fact, it's embodied in both federal case law and the Ohio Equal Pay Act.
And it's just coincidental that was so in every one of these women's cases. We had one woman, I think, in the upper management, and I think she was even paid less than the rest of them. But it's just coincidental that this happened to all women.
It did not happen to all women.
Well, these four women.
I can address each of the four. going again beyond what I just said as to Mr. Herr versus Ms. Glider. Mr. Herr had 3D faculty, had documentation skills, I've already mentioned methodology skills, and he had already mastered 3D imaging capabilities. He in fact trained himself on new software at SkyCon without assistance of outside training. Ms. Glider did not have these skills. This was not a just cause for discharge situation, Donna. This was a reduction in force, and no one is saying that Ms. Glider was a poor performer. But when an employer has to let go people on a reduction in force, some good people lose their jobs. 23 people lost their jobs. 16 of them were men. 7 of them were women. 4 of the 7 sued. There was a defense verdict for 2 of them. There is nothing in this record that compels any inference that this is gender discrimination. Again, getting back to the comparison we're asking to do, I'm happy to go on to Ms. DeLuca and Ms. Noah, because they were both accountants.
Well, again, that's comparing the facts, and we can do that by reading the briefs. Would you talk a little bit about why there was really no women in the MIP program?
First of all, Your Honor, the MIP program was only 2 years old in 1995. So to say there were never, ever any women must be viewed in the context of the reality that this is a brand new program for BICON. It was a program that was evolving as the 8-point system evolved. The MIP program, the Management Incentive Plan, defined eligibility by a 8-point number, as you know from the record. The 8-point system was only introduced in 1993 and was being fine-tuned throughout 1994 and 95. In 1995, 7 additional people became eligible for the MIP, including one woman, Christine Keller. By virtue of the contractual obligations of the people who became eligible in the MIP program, that would become effective January 1, 1996. Ms. Keller was eligible in 95 to be effective in 1996, and in fact, she became a member of the MIP January 1, 1996. Interestingly, Your Honor, of those new people who were eligible in 1995, the rest were male, and one of them was terminated in the RIF. If you look at the RIF chart of the 23 people who were terminated, 3 of them are men who were in the MIP program. You can draw no inferences whatsoever about whether the MIP program itself was gender discriminatory. And in addition to that, you can draw no inferences whatsoever as to the eligibility of the people for the MIP program based upon their salary. There's no analysis given, and health made no attempt at trial or indeed here before this court to explain who these people were who were in the MIP program, how they got there, when they were hired, what their qualifications were, what their job experience was, what their seniority was, what their education was. You can draw no inferences from raw statistics.
You brought up Ms. Keller and said that she got into the hate program and the MIP program in 1996, but she was passed over in 94 when she had a higher hate point than Mr. Green, who was put in the MIP. How do you explain that?
It was explained at trial, Your Honor, and you recall the transcripts, and I will reiterate again what was said in our brief. Mr. Green, as you recall, was the prior controller before Mr. McCullough came in, before Mr. Kazarowski joined the two accounting departments. Mr. Green, and this is Ms. Gladstone's testimony at trial, Mr. Green, as the former controller, had the same pay point as Mr. McCullough. When he was transferred out of accounting into manufacturing in 1994, as you recall, he was no longer Ms. Noack's supervisor, he was reappointed to a different 8-point number. It was intended to be a lateral transfer, and the reappointing had not caught up with him. He was in the MIT program from its inception in 1993. He was never not in the MIT program. So the hate point number that was assigned to him was not the correct hate point number in 1994. So he was, as this last judge testified at trial, he was grandfathered in.
So you're saying that his hate point was always higher than Ms. Keller in 94 and 95?
He had a hate point in excess of 600 in 1993 and 1994, and the hate point that you see on the document indicating that his manufacturing title carried a different hate point, but as Ms. Glasschuk testified, was that was not correct. The hate pointing was done outside of Bicron in Ohio, it was done in Massachusetts. The hate pointing was incorrect for him. It was a clerical error. He was never out of the MIT program. He was always in it.
Thank you.
At the time of the RIF program, was Mr. Green still with the company?
He was.
That was one of the things that impressed me as I went through this, that he seems to me to be part of management. And he testified, did he not, that in fact, what was being done with regard to Ms. Nowak was a violation of the equal opportunity policies of the company.
May I respond to that? The question put to him was in relation to Ms. Nowak, was in relation to his request for her pay increase in 1994. He was, during part of that year, he was the controller. This was before he was transferred into manufacturing. He put in a pay request, or a pay increase request on her behalf. He asked for, I believe, an 8% raise. In fact, there's a memo in the file where he said, I feel so strongly about this that I'm willing to give up my raise for Ms. Nowak. The head of the accountant, Douglas Kasarowski, agreed that Ms. Nowak should get a pay increase. He approved a 7% raise, not the 8%, but this was still 2 points above the average pay raise, merit pay raise for that department. Before the pay raise was implemented, however, he was transferred out, and he had no personal knowledge as to what actually happened to her, other than what he learned at trial, or he learned subsequent to that. The question to him was, do you think that she was treated unfairly, presumed that she did not get the raise that was requested? He had no personal knowledge about what happened or the reasons for it. He had no personal knowledge, and he agreed that he did not know why Mr. Willing was paid more than Ms. Nowak.
Was he let go during the reduction in force?
Green. He was not in water. He was currently employed when he testified.
So he had no real reason to, in effect, testify against his employer.
Well, I don't think that he was testifying against the employer. I think his testimony made perfect sense. He had no idea what happened. He wasn't there. He was speculating. He even admitted he had no basis to compare Ms. Willing's salary with Mr. Willing's salary with Snowy's salary. He had nothing to do with setting Mr. Willing's salary, with the hate winding of the two, and he had no knowledge of his prior experience in Delaware before he came to Ohio, and he had no knowledge of the legitimate non-discriminatory factors that went into this pay differential. So his guessing that without any information on the face of it, he didn't know why DJ Nowak was making less than and Mr. Willing made perfect sense because he had no information and he testified that he had no information.
Counsel, isn't this just simply a case where there is sufficient evidence for the case to go to the jury and the Court of Appeals substituted their decisions over the jury's decisions?
That is not the case, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals painstakingly went through every single bit of evidence in 129 pages.
But it substituted their judgment for the judgment of the jury.
The job of the Court of Appeals on Rule 50 motion, review of the Rule 50 motion, is to substitute its judgment for the judgment of the trial court.
Isn't the Court of Appeals obligated to affirm the decision of the trial court if there is sufficient evidence upon which that verdict was based?
Yes.
And there was in this case, and they didn't.
That's there was not sufficient evidence, Your Honor.
Okay.
The job of the Court of Appeals is to determine whether the evidence presented is relevant, probative, admissible, and that's exactly what this Court did. The Court of Appeals did not in any one instance, weigh the credibility of any of the witnesses. They concluded that the evidence that went to the jury consisted of hearsay.
You can guarantee that they didn't weigh the credibility of the witnesses.
Your Honor, if you read that case, they viewed the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant in the recitation of the facts. Your Honor, they painstakingly went through the testimony of every single witness. And despite the fact that this trial lasted 2.5 weeks and there were many pieces of paper and plaintiff chose to call 21 witnesses, when all is said and done, the evidence consisted primarily of hearsay, flawed statistics, circumstantial evidence that had no causal relationship at all with the challenged employment decision, and conjecture, speculation, and guesswork on the part of the appellants themselves.
When did we do away with circumstantial evidence?
Your Honor, the circumstantial evidence is perfectly... Circumstantial evidence as a type of proof is perfectly legitimate in this type of case. I'm not disputing that. The circumstantial evidence here had no nexus. It had no relationship at all. There was no causal effect between the types of evidence and the evidence that was submitted and the challenged employment decisions here. And getting back to Justice Resnick's earlier statement that perhaps some case needs to be presented to reconcile Burns and Mosley, if that is true, and I'm not agreeing that there is, this is certainly not the case, because the Court of Appeals here had no problem in accepting circumstantial evidence as a type of evidence which could be used to show pretext, just as direct evidence could. The Court of Appeals here did not stop its analysis at the confrontation level. The Court of Appeals here did not reject any type of evidence. In fact, it followed the directives of this court in Muncie. But what happened here is that the Court of Appeals found no nexus between all of that evidence and the challenge to the court.
Thank you, Ms. Harry. Mr. Sandell, you've saved 4 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. You know, the remarks of Ms. Harry made my point. There is no evidence in this record, by the way, that I can take a lot of paper in mind, that the pay point from Mr. Green was clear or clear. This is not in the record. There is no evidence in this record that I can be able to find that the MIP program was only 2 years old. I don't remember that. I was there. You will find evidence in the record directly contradicting the statements made about this minor as a piercer's occur and his lack of experience compared to her. Many years that she had in our company, the fact that she was denied certain kinds of training in the absence. The fact is, Mr. Burr didn't even act as an engineer for a couple of years in Boxing. He was a transfer.
Mr. Sindel, let me interrupt you. If we were to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals, would we not do it on the basis that the Court of Appeals should not have indicated that there should have been a directed verdict for the plaintiffs, that there should have been a directed verdict for the defendants here? That's what the Court of Appeals said on the disparity in the salary. Yeah, for the
and I think the JNOB, same thing, really. Yes.
That's not new law, is it? I mean, we would just be reversing, I guess, saying the Court of Appeals, you erred because this is not JNOB or not a directed verdict case. It was properly sent to the jury.
Well, I suppose there's nothing new under the sun. Everything's new. The fact is, general propositions of law are always the same. The question is how they are applied. I want to be clear about our position. We're talking about the deprivation of the constitutional right to trial by jury. When, on a routine basis, courts throughout the state, for whatever confusion or reason they seem to have in employment cases where this re-weighing of evidence goes on, you're denying, courts of appeals are denying plaintiffs the right to a civil jury. And that's a matter that should concern this court.
Is that by virtue, I guess that proposition with regard to directed verdicts and judgment, JNOV, is that the position you would take, that where courts take that side road and divert from the jury decision, that is error or wrong, or how is that to deprive? Because we know that that's part of our civil rules, that directed verdicts are legitimate.
I'm going to see if I can address that, Your Honor. I think what you're saying is, yes, it is part of our civil rules that courts of appeals and trial courts, appellate rules, have the prerogative in the appropriate circumstances to reverse the verdict and judgment for the other side based on the evidence, based on the absence of evidence or insufficiency of it. The point here is that sufficiency of the evidence has to assume all of the inferences, all of the facts in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, and when routinely courts don't do that.
Okay. It's really in the practice that you think that it's error, not in principle. Obviously, it's not a deprivation of a right to jury. Sure.
I don't think there's anything wrong with civil rules, but I do think there's a real conflict in the way that, frankly, this court has instructed lower courts between Mousy and Burns. First of all, Burns is a decision.
And you realize on exactly where did the Court of Appeals appear to struggle between Mousy and Burns?
Well,
where did they?
It sounded like to me.
Did they discuss their struggles with those two cases? Well, I didn't see that.
No, they didn't discuss the struggles with the two cases. I think it's apparent from the decision, the way it was analyzed. In other words, the thing that you need to address here, and I think this is what the Court of Appeals did, Justice Piper, is use a McDonnell-Douglas analysis to review a jury.
Excuse me, sir. Whoever has a telephone, please either turn it off or leave the courtroom. It's not appropriate to have telephones ringing in the courtroom.
Or both.
Excuse me, Mr. Sindel. You may.
They analyzed it in accordance with the McDonnell-Douglas test. Every one of those. Now, what I understood Mousy to mean, and I think it's correct, I think Justice Resnick's dissenting opinion is essentially correct there, I'm about to support that, is that the McDonnell-Douglas test is only applicable where there is an absence of any evidence of discrimination, and it is a test by elimination. Because you've eliminated everything else, it must therefore be. It's really a test to aid a plaintiff in difficult proof of discrimination cases. Now, Mousy makes it pretty clear that that should be the case. Burns, however, it takes a different position. Now, the Court of Appeals analyzed it, I think, in a McDonnell-Douglas way. You can see it again and again and again through each case as their prima facie case. The problem is, juries don't think that way. Juries take all of the evidence. Only lawyers and judges think prima facie case, adverse action, articulated reason, pretext. I mean, that's one way the lawyers disagree something like that.
You've used your time, Mr. Sindel. Your red light's on.
Okay, if I can just finish my last breath, then I'll go. Juries don't think that way, and so by my conclusion, I would say you need to evaluate this case and set a standard for jury verdicts that is consistent with how juries look at cases. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.